Iran says any IAEA resolution against its nuclear program will have a negative impact both on cooperation with the UN agency and on the JCPOA revival talks. Syrian air defenses shoot down most of the missiles that Israel fires at targets south of Damascus. And the U.S. warning of a forceful response in case North Korea conducts a nuclear test. Thanks for joining us. The IAEA Board of Governors convenes a meeting in the Austrian capital amid a push by the U.S. and its Western allies for an anti-Iran resolution. Tehran has, however, vowed a proportionate response to any anti-Iran measure at the agency's meeting. The Iranian Foreign Ministry spokesman has dismissed as unconstructive the potential resolution drafted by the U.S., the U.K., France, and Germany, with the backing of Israel. Saeed Khatibzadeh said resolution will have a negative impact on Iran's cooperation with the U.N. agency and on the JCPOA revival talks. The measure is aimed at accusing Iran of lacking cooperation with the IAEA and not doing enough to resolve the so-called outstanding issues with the agency. The IAEA chief, meanwhile, has repeated his rhetoric against Iran's nuclear program.
What we got from them is clearly not sufficient, or it's inadequate. So with this, we cannot move forward. And the problem here is that Iran needs to continue working with us. They have a very important, very ambitious nuclear program, as you know. And now their declarations are in question, because there are loopholes, there are doubts, which are relatively important. So I think it's in their own interest to clear this in order to continue. There is no other way, to be honest, there is no other way.
The Islamic Republic has already warned the IAEA that politically motivated decisions under the pressure of Israel and the West will undermine its cooperation with the UN nuclear watchdog. Iran has time and again reiterated that its nuclear program is for peaceful purposes. Syrian media say the country's air defenses have intercepted Israeli missiles over the southern part of Damascus province. According to a military source, Israeli missiles were fired at targets south of the capital Damascus from the occupied Golan Heights. The source added that Syria's air defenses shot down most Israeli missiles, and the attack only caused material damage. Israel frequently attacks Syria, but rarely claims responsibility. Damascus says Tel Aviv carries out the attacks to aid terrorist groups fighting against the Syrian army. Damascus has repeatedly complained to the UN about Israeli raids, calling for international condemnation of the violation of its sovereignty and territorial integrity. Palestinians have held a sit-in in the besieged Gaza Strip to drum up support for prisoners languishing in Israeli jails. They expressed anger over deplorable conditions of Palestinian inmates in Israeli jails and their systematic torture and harassment. Ashraf Shannon has more from the Gaza Strip.
Families of Palestinian prisoners and rights activists have held a sit-in protest inside the office of the International Committee of the Red Cross in Gaza. They protested Israel's inhumane treatment of some 5,000 political prisoners held in Israeli jails. Their solidarity action comes as some 450 administrative detainees have been refusing to show up for the military court hearings for more than 6 months. These detainees are held in Israeli jails without charge or trial for a long time. Their only recourse to call attention to their plight has been hunger strikes. Among them, Khalil Awaudeh has been refusing food for more than 3 months, and Raed Rayyan has adopted the same passive resistance approach since more than 2 months ago.
We are talking about the Palestinian administrative detainees who are boycotting the Israeli military court since the beginning of this year, to demanding to stop the administrative detention. And nowadays, two Palestinian detainees are ongoing on their hunger strike.
Palestinian prisoners are held in 24 Israeli prisons and detention centers, where rights groups say they are denied their basic human rights.
Palestinian prisoners are being held under inhumane conditions inside Israeli jails. Israel refuses to respect the international conventions regarding the treatment of prisoners. We will continue our solidarity and our resistance until all our prisoners are free.
Prisoners' advocacy groups also condemned Israel's inhumane treatment of Palestinian prisoners, especially those suffering from chronic medical conditions.
Medical negligence, which is targeting hundreds of Palestinian sick prisoners, this procedure, we always talk about it, and we demand the international community to interfere and to stop such policies, and also the invasions, the daily invasions to the sections and prisons of Palestinian detainees.
Securing the release of prisoners is a highly emotive issue for Palestinians who regard them as prisoners of war and as symbols of resistance against the Israeli occupation.
Rights groups are calling on the international community to hold the Israeli regime accountable for its grave violations against Palestinian prisoners. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
The United States is sending a message to North Korea that it's ready to act forcefully if it conducts a new nuclear test. Here's Deputy Secretary of State Wendy Sherman warning of a strong response.
Any nuclear test would be in complete violation of UN Security Council resolutions. There would be a swift and forceful response to such a test, and I believe that not only the ROK in the United States and Japan, but the entire world will respond in a strong and clear manner.
Sherman, who is currently visiting Seoul, says Pyongyang's possible nuke test will be at the heart of the conversation during a trilateral meeting with her South Korean and Japanese counterparts tomorrow. The U.S. and South Korea held joint war games last week that featured an American nuclear-powered aircraft carrier and a strike group. In response, North Korea fired 8 ballistic missiles in one of its largest ever tests, and that triggered a tit-for-tat launch of 8 surface-to-surface missiles by the U.S. and South Korea. There's speculation that the North is preparing for a nuclear test in the days ahead. If conducted, that would be its first since the year 2017.
North Korea has fired 8 short-range ballistic missiles toward the sea off its east coast. South Korea says the missiles were fired from an area of the North Korean capital, Pyongyang. In recent weeks, North Korea has test-fired a range of ballistic missiles, including its largest intercontinental ballistic missile. The latest one comes just a day after South Korea and the United States wrapped up their first combined military drills involving an American aircraft carrier in more than 4 years. Pyongyang has frequently protested against Seoul and Washington's joint military exercises, calling them rehearsals for invasion, despite Washington's talk of diplomacy. The latest test marks the 18th time that North Korea has fired its missiles this year, including what the U.S. says was a failed intercontinental ballistic missile test on May 4th that exploded shortly after launch. Last month, North Korea's leader, Kim Jong-un, said he would strengthen and develop his country's nuclear forces at the highest possible speed. U.S. President Joe Biden's administration has failed to restart diplomatic talks with Pyongyang as tensions escalate. Former U.S. President Donald Trump attempted to court Pyongyang, but even though he met with the North Korean leader 3 times, he refused to relieve any of the sanctions in return for the several steps taken by Pyongyang toward denuclearization. That hampered further diplomacy between Pyongyang and Washington and prompted Kim to announce an end to a moratorium on the country's missile tests.
So it understands that a country that does not have a formidable arsenal can be subject to U.S. attack because it's considered weak. So this is part of it. Well, if it wants to remain the hermit kingdom, it must look to be strong and unpredictable, and this is how it uses its military, the projection of its military force.
North Korea, which has been under rounds of crushing UN sanctions since 2006 over its nuclear and ballistic missile programs, has ramped up its missile launches this year. The sanctions have led to rising levels of poverty and food insecurity. Despite the acknowledged food insecurity in North Korea, however, the United Nations Humanitarian Response Plan does not include an appeal for assistance to North Korea. A UN World Food Program report in 2019 concluded that 11 million of North Korea's 25 million people were undernourished, and one of every five children were stunted from lack of adequate nutrition.
China and Russia have voiced opposition to further sanctions by the UN Security Council against North Korea. Late last year, the two countries pushed the Council to remove certain sanctions on the North in recognition of steps Pyongyang had taken to denuclearize and to encourage further negotiations.
Last month, China and Russia vetoed a U.S.-led push at the United Nations to toughen sanctions on North Korea over its renewed ballistic missile launches. China, the North's closest ally, and Russia, whose relations with the West have sharply deteriorated over its military operation in Ukraine, said they would have preferred a non-binding statement instead of a fresh resolution against Pyongyang. Beijing warned that sanctions would cause an escalation and humanitarian consequences for North Korea, which has been recently hit by COVID outbreak. Meanwhile, Russia said Washington is ignoring Pyongyang's appeals to stop hostile activity. During the past 16 years, the UN Security Council has steadily and unanimously ramped up sanctions to cut off funding for North Korea's nuclear weapons and ballistic missile programs. Since 2017, when the Council last stepped up sanctions on Pyongyang, China and Russia have been trying to ease sanctions on humanitarian grounds.
Because it's a coercive power. It doesn't want to treat another country on equal or humane terms because, I mean, it doesn't want to preserve the current leadership of North Korea. It wants regime change.
In particular, China's strategic overture to North Korea since the collapse of U.S.-North Korea diplomatic talks in 2019 has drawn the two countries closer. With tensions rising over the U.S.-China competition and a new South Korean conservative government that vows to take a harder line on North Korea and China, Beijing has more incentive to keep Pyongyang close.
Several South and Central American countries slammed the U.S. policy of exclusion after Washington refuses to invite Venezuela, Nicaragua, and Cuba to the Summit of the Americas. The Summit of the Americas is due to be held this week in Los Angeles. The Chilean president says the U.S. has made a mistake. Gabriel Boric says the U.S. move will reinforce the position that excluded states take in their own countries. Cuba, for its part, lambasted the exclusion in a statement, describing it as, quote, anti-democratic and arbitrary. Mexico's President Manuel López Obrador has also reacted by boycotting the summit. He says that Washington needs to change its policy of exclusion and the desire to dominate without any reason. The Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro praised the Mexican President's, quote, courage and clarity for choosing not to attend the summit. He said U.S.'s decision to exclude three countries is an act of discrimination, which ensures that the summit will fail. British Prime Minister has survived a confidence vote triggered by members of his party. Boris Johnson has escaped, losing his post amid growing calls for him to resign over a raft of issues, including the Partygate scandal. Our correspondent Syed Purisa reports from London.
The moment of truth for the embattled British Prime Minister at the end of a day rife with speculation about his political survival.
Good evening. I can report, as returning officer, that 359 ballots were cast, no spoiled ballots, that the vote in favour of having confidence in Boris Johnson as leader was 211 votes, and the vote against was 148 votes.
It's a result that means Boris Johnson is now a weakened leader and with an uncertain future, although he himself doesn't think so.
Well, I think this is a very good result for politics and for the country.
Just in, it's
just I do. Just in this sense, I think it's a convincing result, a decisive result. And what it means is that as a government, we can move on and focus on the stuff that I think really matters.
But it's exactly this stuff that matters to people that forced members of his own Conservative Party to call for a no-confidence vote. Lockdown law-breaking parties held at government buildings at the height of the pandemic, when families were banned from visiting even dying relatives.
This vote was inevitable. We all knew it was coming. It was just a matter of getting the Jubilee out of the way. Why? Because the Conservative Party is really nervous about losing the next election. Let's not pretend this is about high principle. Boris Johnson was elected as an electoral asset. Now he's an electoral liability, and he's going to stay that way as far as I can see.
The sticky Partygate scandal played a major role in Conservative MPs challenging Johnson's position, but it was not the only reason.
It's about the end of party time in so many different areas. His green agenda is nothing to do with Conservative policy and is, in my view, directly responsible for the cost of living crisis. He's apparently failed to deliver on the Northern Ireland Protocol, which is essential to a unionist party, a party that doesn't want to see the breakup of the United Kingdom. And then there are small gaffes, times when he just doesn't look like he's taking the job seriously.
Things came to a boiling point over the weekend when the Prime Minister was booed at an event celebrating the Queen's 70-year rule. And prior to Monday's vote, allegations of intimidation and arm-twisting by number 10 trying to get Conservative MPs to change their minds. And the last-ditch effort by Boris Johnson himself writing to MPs begging for a second chance.
So Boris Johnson managed to survive this vote on his premiership, but by a number that will continue to be an open wound for the members of his Conservative Party, which is why some experts say he won't be able to hold on to power for much longer. Saeedpour is up, London.
And that is for this edition of World News. It's bye-bye for now.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality, youth, Eastern Tales, roundtable discussions, culture, politics, all produced by IRIB English Radio.
ایمان را در خودتون تقویت بکنید، ایمانی که هم در اینجا شما را شرافتمند می کند و هم در پیشگاه حق آبرو دارید و با آبرومندی وارد می شید به تخت اعلی.
In the path of the Imam.
In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. If you remember, we discussed Imam Khomeini's advice on political groups, particularly the parties affiliated to the West and the East, urging them to give up enmity against the Islamic system and joining the nation. This time, we are going to touch upon his advice to writers and speakers who unfairly used to weaken the Islamic Republic and the strenuous efforts of the nation. Stay tuned, please. Imam Khomeini, God's mercy upon him, used to advise writers, speakers, and so-called intellectuals who would try to divert the course of the Islamic Republic toward the big powers and trivialize the goals achieved by the nation, especially martyrs and their selfless families. He writes in his testament, "My advice to writers, speakers, intellectuals, and those who forge false is that, instead of spending your time against the course of the Islamic Republic and doing your best in suspicion, ill wish, and ill speaking towards the parliament, government, and other servants to lead the country to the superpowers, have your lonely moments with your God for one night, and if you don't believe in God, have lonely moments with your conscience and examine your inward motive to see by which criterion and furnace you ignore the blood of these youth in the fronts and cities. You have staged nervous war against the nation who want to get rid of the yoke of oppressors and external and internal looters, and selflessly preserve the independence and freedom which they have achieved by sacrificing their lives and the lives of their dear ones. You are fomenting sedition and treacherous conspiracies and open the way for the arrogant and oppressors. Is it not better if you would guide the government and the parliament and the nation with your thoughts, pen, and speech for safeguarding the country? Would it not worth for you to help this oppressed and deprived nation and to assist to stabilize the Islamic establishment?" Imam Khomeini, elsewhere in his testament, addressing the writers and speakers, says, "Do you consider this parliament, president, government, and the judiciary worse than what was there during the former regime? Have you forgotten the oppressions that damned regime used to enforce against this oppressed nation? Don't you know that the Islamic country was a military base for America and it used to be behaved like a colony and the parliament, the government, and the military forces were in their control? And what their advisors, industrialists, and specialists would do to this nation and their reserves? Has it escaped your memory, the promotion of indecency all over the country and the centers of corruption, including the brothels, gambling houses, bars, cinemas, and other centers, each of which was a great factor to corrupt the young generation? Have you forgotten the totally corruption-inducing mass media and magazines and the newspapers of that regime? The founder of the Islamic Republic of Iran castigated the March 3, 1981 events in which then-President Abul Hassan Bani Sadr had deceived a handful of gullible elements and naive youth to change the course of the Islamic Revolution toward the West by murdering innocent people and revolutionary students in Tehran University. The Imam said, "Do you link and shake brotherly hands with those who explicitly condemn Islam and have staged armed rebellion against it or have embarked on rebellion with pen and tongue, which is more regrettable than armed uprising? And do you call those whom God has described as worthy of being killed as apple of eyes and sit beside the players who created the disaster of March 3rd and beat innocent youth to death and watched the event? Is this an Islamic and ethical act? And has the practice of the government and the judiciary, which have duly punished the opponents, deviant and heathens, cause you to shout in defense of the innocent? I regret for you, brothers, whose past record I know to some extent, and I am interested in some of you, but not for those who were wicked ones in the guise of benevolence and were wolves in the garb of shepherd and players who had ridiculed everyone and were hell-bent on corrupting the country and the nation and were serving one of the looting poles, those who wickedly martyred the valuable youth and men and ulema training the society and had no mercy on innocent Muslim children. These people have scandalized themselves in the society and before the all-dominant God and have no way to return as the Satan of the soul, prompting to evil, is ruling them. Imam Khomeini writes elsewhere in his testament as he addresses writers and speakers, "You faithful brothers, why don't you help the government and parliament which are trying to serve the deprived and oppressed, and you are just complaining? Have you compared the skill of service of the government and foundations of the Islamic Republic with the hardships and disorders which are natural for every revolution? And have you compared the imposed war with so much damage and millions of foreign and domestic homeless and excessive sabotages during this short period with construction activities of the former regime? Don't you know that the construction activities of that time were limited nearly to cities and that to the wealthy neighborhoods, and the poor and deprived people enjoyed little and nothing of those things, while the current government and the Islamic foundations are serving this deprived stratum wholeheartedly? You, the faithful, support the government so that the affairs are fulfilled soon, so that you may go to the Lord's presence, which you will go willy-nilly with the badge of serving his servants."
Joining us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
The International Atomic Energy Agency, the IAEA, has begun its regular Board of Governors meeting in Vienna with Iran's nuclear issue and Tehran's cooperation with the UN nuclear watchdog expected to take center stage, although the agency has said that Iran's cooperation with the agency remains, well, a lot to be desired. To put it in other words, its tone critical, however, stopping short of an outright resolution against Iran, at least for the time being. In this edition of The Spotlight, we will look at the double standards of the agency and whether the failing maximum pressure campaign adopted by the E3, along with the U.S. at its side, will lead to the derailment of the talks. But first, let me introduce our guest for this edition of The Spotlight. Journalist and political analyst Said Mostafa Khoshchesh joins us from Tehran. Also joining us, academic and political analyst Tohid Asadi, who also joins us from Tehran.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Gemma, welcome to you both. Let me first start with you, Said Mostafa Khoshchesh, if I may. And perhaps you can give us a lesson in English and define for us what this means, this particular verb that I'm about to tell you. Reading off what the news has said, major European countries and the U.S. are expected to seek to censor Iran. Now, I looked up censor in the dictionary. It says express severe disapproval of someone or something, especially in a formal statement. But maybe you can put that into perspective for us, what it means.
Okay. Hello, thanks for having me. Let me explain it this way. An IAEA Board of Governors resolution that they have warned to adopt could produce various results that vary from just censuring Iran and reprimanding to the worst-case scenario, sending and referring Iran's case to the UN Security Council, voting on revival of sanctions, which would definitely receive the Chinese and the Russian vetoing and would lead to nowhere, producing no result for the Americans and Europeans. So it's a political show with no action and with no, you know, result in perspective. Because if they really meant action, they wouldn't need adopting a resolution at the IAEA. They could simply resort to a faster, easier way to go for the trigger mechanism, which would refer the case to a UN Security Council veto-proof voting on the revival of sanctions, which would put an end to the Vienna talks, put an end to the JCPOA, and that's it. So it's no strange that they have gone for a political circus show. Because after the Iranian initiative last month made Borrell and Mora of the European foreign policy chief, actually, and his deputy happy for a few hours when he was returning from Iran to Europe, and he until he received the similar no bullying response of the United States to push the talks into a deadlock, Washington has been using its worn-out instruments and scenarios that have been in use for the past four decades against Iran, including resorting to cyber attacks, resorting to media warfare, promoting the weak opposition as if they've never been supporting them and they've just started supporting them, just to magnify, you know, the impact of their propaganda, and using Israel for cyber terror and sabotage attacks, and the last one being the threat to adopt an IAEA resolution, all for one purpose: levy political pressure through these worn-out scenarios to make Iran retreat in the Vienna talks.
Okay.
Iranian response, definitely we'll talk about it later.
Sure. Well, let's take a look at what Rafael Grossi has said, the IAEA Director General, Tohid Asadi. He came out when the Board of Governors began and basically repeating his anti-Iran rhetoric. He made some allegations that since February 23, 2021, the agency activities have been seriously affected by Iran's decision. But what's very interesting, if you go to the IAEA website, there's a page where it says joint statement by Mohammad Islami, the VP and president of the Atomic Energy Organization of Iran, and Mr. Rafael Grossi, where it says the AEOI and the IAEA have agreed in the continuation of the cooperation as stated in the joint statement of 26 August of 2020. So I said all that, meaning that both in the IAEA state website have acknowledged cooperation, yet Rafael Grossi comes on and says, we're not getting the cooperation that is required. Can you please explain to us the discrepancy here, as I stated?
Yeah. First of all, thank you very much for having me. And secondly, as Said Mustafa was mentioning in a very correct way, there is a wide spectrum of evidence to put forth the claim that the performance, the decisions, and the courses of action that we have been observing from as far as IAEA is concerned, actually, all in all, if you just take a look at what they're doing, it is a clear indicative of the very fact that the behavior is quite unstable and under impact of a, let's say, range of or a set of determinants that shouldn't be. So basically, when we're talking about IAEA, we are talking about a so-called technical body, international body, which should set its decisions on the basis of technical issues. But in practice, when it comes to the decisions that we see pertaining to Iran, most of the time, these decisions are made on the basis of political considerations, and these kinds of discrepancies, this kind of, paradoxes that you see and you properly refer to are coming basically from this basis. We know that there is a clear lack of partial performance when it comes to IAEA due to the influence of third parties, regimes like Israeli regime, the United States, and other actors and players which try to put their political will and impose their political will upon IAEA. So the result is that we see less technical, reports and more political reports from the side of this international body. The consequence, of course, as far as the Iranian side is concerned, is that such a performance could easily kill the trust of Iranians, and I think it has already done that. And if they decide to act on their right minds and just provide a better circumstances, not only for the ongoing talks in Vienna, which again, due to such decisions, faced a kind of, stopping due to such courses of action. But also if they really try to prove the world that they are such an independent organization, they have to reconsider their decisions. And it is not really limited to Iran. Just take a look at Israel and take a look at how IAEA faces this regime, regardless of all things that we know about the nuclear facilities of this brutal regime. So I think it goes without saying that the unstable behavior and this zigzagging policy formulation, zigzagging decisions that are coming from IAEA are all showing that it's not an independent body which right. should trust it. And this double standards that Said Mustafa properly mentioned is observable in a tangible way in the performance of this international body.
Before we continue with the rest of our discussion, I have to ask you, Said Mustafa Khoshesh, about the new sanctions that were announced by the U.S. Treasury Department, which is somewhat confusing because the press release says members of the Terrorist Financing Targeting Center, TFTC, sanctioned 16 individuals, entities, and groups. And then it says all of these targets have been previously designated by the U.S., and they include three individuals associated with Iran's Islamic Revolutionary Guards Corps, Quds Force. Can you explain these sanctions for us and why they're coming at this time when the Board of Governors meeting began?
Well, it's completely clear, as I explained the first question, in response to the first question. They're using every possible means. That's why, actually, I said these are worn-out scenarios and instruments, because They are now copy-pasting these sanctions. It started under Donald Trump in order to build up different layers, actually four layers of similar sanctions. Sometimes they vary in names and in wording, but the purpose is the same. Sometimes the sanction is altogether the same, just to leave psychological impact on Iran first. Second, to remove one of these layers under a possible deal and keep the similar sanctions actually with similar impacts and effects in place so that Iran cannot benefit from any kind of deal and will be forced to go for JCPOAs over its other power components like the missile industry and regional power. But it's quite, you know, a notorious move. Just last week at a Senate hearing, Rand Paul also made similar, you know, statements similar to what you just said, that if you're dealing with Iran, you need to show goodwill. It's called, even from the American perspective, it's called carrot and stick. He was objecting, you know, he's a Republican, he's an American senator, and he's not on the side of Iran. He was saying, okay, you've always shown the stick side, like Donald Trump, you've never shown any kind of carrot. If you really are honest in talks with Iran, you need to remove part of the sanctions and ask Iran to join for further negotiations to discuss, you know, the deal. But you're just, he said, you have just declared, and he was speaking to Rob Mali, the UN envoy in Iran, that you have just declared new rounds of sanctions, similar sanctions that you just mentioned. They were first declared by Rob Mali in a Senate hearing last week, and Rand Paul was objecting to this kind of policy. They do not really mean, you know, to remove the sanctions. They have never meant that, because they do not mean to resolve the conflict with Iran. This has already been proved under six agreements with Iran in the past 22 years.
Okay.
The JCPOA was the sixth one. What they want is not a conflict resolution. They want to contain Iran. This is called the containment strategy. So they reinvigorate the sanctions, do the copy-pasting in order to keep them in place.
Right. Well, let's take a look at what the AEOI chief has said. Iran's AEOI chief here, Toida Sadi, concerning two issues which Rafael Grossi has mentioned, which appears to be the two sticking points, if you want to call it that. Of course, there's always a sticking point, even if things get clarified. But one of them has to deal with the idea that Rafael Grossi says these nuclear particles were found in three alleged nuclear sites. You have the AEOI chief saying that Rafael Grossi does not have serious will to admit that Iran's answers are convincing. And he also, on that issue, said that the IAEA invokes intelligence reports provided to it by Iran's enemies with the Israeli regime at the top. He gave those two answers, but it seems like answers were given on these alleged nuclear particles that they're talking about. The other has to deal with the cameras, of which, Aslami said, we have already made it clear to the IAEA that access to this surveillance data and recordings depends on the fate of the agreement, the JCPOA. Sounds like he's given his answers. Why is the IAEA still pursuing the path on these two issues?
Well, let me just touch upon the idea of sanctions and U.S. sanctions for just a few sentences. I'm going to get back to that question immediately. But I think when we're talking about the United States foreign policy pertaining to Iran, we're talking about a wider grand strategy rather than small tactics. So when we're talking about sanctions, when we're talking about imposing some let's say statements on international bodies, these are all part of a bigger or let's say wider toolbox in the foreign policy behavior of the United States, and this is part of a maximum pressure that Trump started, and now after this isolationism of the United States, they are trying with Biden administration to expand the scope of it to other countries in order to share the burden of this maximum pressure and then have other players involved in it. So that's just one point that I wanted to add. But getting back to your question, I think we see a really paradoxical behavior from the side of IAEA. Of course, part of this paradox, as far as I know, comes from the very fact that most of the reports, most of the statements that we hear from these so-called international bodies and their, let's say, key people, does not really come from the truth and the realities on the ground, but they are coming from some baseless, let's say, accusations and baseless claims that Israeli regime provides them with. And this is part of the obnoxious foreign policy that Israelis and the Americans are following when it comes to Iran. And you see the realization of these, let's say, policies when it comes to IAEA reports or other similar statements. So if you're looking for the reasons behind it, you shouldn't really look for it in Iran, but you have to just take a look at the false, baseless, irrelevant, let's say, lines of argument that have, let's say, irrelevantly met in the Israeli regime. But as far as the camera and in a broader context, as far as the Iran's permissions for IAEA to have access to its nuclear facilities are concerned, the truth, again, is that Iran has shown for the past years, and particularly after JCPOA was signed and sealed back in 2015, all these years and for the years even down the road, we can say that Iran has shown and will show a kind of extraordinary flexibility to giving access to the cameras and other things.
So exactly.
Extraordinary monitoring here. But regardless of this huge amount of being cooperative, what we see in response, which is quite disappointing, is such negative statements that we hear and we see from the, let's say, key people in this in these international organizations.
And I'm glad you mentioned that, because the cooperation is out there, and even the IAEA has acknowledged the cooperation that Iran has had, and Sayed Mostafa Khoshesh, everybody knows, I'm hoping, that is, at this point, that the IAEA's inspection is one of the hardest and toughest and most extensive. So why do you have the IAEA Director General, of which it seems like they're cherry-picking his statements, say, since they, Iran, are continuing with the process to enrich uranium, well, then it's a matter of just a few weeks to get enough material to create a nuclear bomb, where in reality, an expert says weaponizing will still take 1 to 2 years.
More, even more, because weaponizing, nuclear materials comes in three phases. First is producing uranium, enriching uranium above 93.4%. Second, means of delivery. And then the third phase is minimizing, the needed material into small space and weaponizing it so that it detonates and creates the impact. So it needs three steps. It takes a long, long way for any country to do that. So the answer is pretty well clear. Iran has been under the harshest regime of inspections before the JCPOA and after the JCPOA, and they've never found a shred of evidence. But on the eve of the JCPOA endorsement, the ex-IAEA Director General, Yuki Amano, was asked if he would declare Iranian nuclear program to be completely peaceful based on the contents of the JCPOA. There are two ways that this dossier is ended. One, waiting for 10 years for a final decision of the major powers in Iran, or 2 years before that, on the eighth year, if the IAEA declares that Iran is pursuing a completely peaceful nuclear program, then everything is ended, everything will be normalized, and done is done. And the former IAEA Director General said, even if it's proved to us, we will not declare that, because Iran's case is no way a legal, technical issue. It's a political issue. The superpowers should make the decision. That is very much telling. The IAEA is not an independent body. It's an instrument, like many other UN affiliated bodies. It's an instrument for the United States to expand its hegemonic rule and to maintain its hegemonic rule. Otherwise, why should the IAEA Director General rely on one main source, that's Israel, that's a sworn enemy of Iran, sworn enemy of the JCPOA, It's not a member of the IAEA. It's not under international surveillance and monitoring and inspections.
Okay.
And while it is suspected of having 200 to 400 nuclear warheads, it's an aggressive regime. It's a killer regime. It's an occupying regime. It has been defying UN members' calls, UN Security Council decisions, and it's a very irresponsible and aggressive regime. Why should it be the source of the IAEA and the IAEA Director General
Very good question.
Travels to the Israel on the eve of the IAEA meeting on Iran?
Right.
It's sending this message that we are also an instrument of the United States. If you don't do what we want, what the U.S. wants, we increase the pressure. And Iranian response is very clear. Under President President Raisi's administration, the policy is active resistance and also muscle flexing and show of power. The hit and run era is gone. If you do any hostile move to us, it will be reciprocated with responses twice tougher, twice more. That was shown in the case of the crude supply of Iran that was seized by the Greek when Iran seized two Greek ships. So I'm here to promise you, I know you're short of time, but let me give you this final sentence. Maybe we won't have time for the next question. If they ratify a resolution at the IAEA on Wednesday, they will receive a response twice more tougher, twice more and twice tougher in a matter of 24 hours. The United States knows from the Greek seizure and Iranian seizure of Greek
what
ships.
What do you think that would be?
It was declared the policy would of Iran, the resistance and the muscle flexing policy was displayed. It was declared by Iran in that story, which happened a few weeks ago, that the hit and run era is gone. Iran's responses would not be balanced. It would be twice more.
Okay.
And the Iranian responses will come in two, three eras. One, nuclear. Two, other power components, including missile industry or regional power. From these three areas, definitely Tehran would provide them with a response in a matter of 24 hours.
Very well. Unfortunately, we've got to end it there.
Americans have realized that Iranian threats are credible, and they would probably retreat into a statement rather than a resolution against Iran.
Very well. We're fresh out of time. Thank you for that, Said Mostafa Khoshesh, journalist and political analyst. Toida Sadi, thank you, academic and political analyst, both from Tehran. With that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight from Mikhail Tafway. It's goodbye.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, everyone. Welcome to IRB English Radio. This is Asma, your humble host for today's episode. And you're hearing me from Q&A on Islamic Belief, in which we shall discuss some very controversial issues. Well, without further ado, I would like to go directly into the main of discussion. But before that, I would like to introduce my guest. Welcome, brother.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah, and thank you for having me.
It's a pleasure to have you here. I'm so happy to meet you here again.
My pleasure.
So here with us, we have Dr. Karimi. And in this episode, we're going to discuss